The following KOPN podcast is made possible by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please consider a donation to listener-supported community radio, KOPN. You can donate securely on our website at kopn.org.
To another edition of Thought Crime Radio, because the media never stops lying. And so we are here to try to balance the plate here, balance diet of information. They can dispense the lies, and we will try to dispense some truth here. So on the phone, I have my co-host, Patricia Robinette.
Hello.
Hi. She is a hypnotherapist from Eugene, Oregon, and
an authoress,
and webmeister. And from Great Britain, I have Guido Preparata, also an author. Guido, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. I can barely hear you, but
hi, Guido.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I do. Hello.
Oh. Okay. I'll try to speak loudly here. So we had Guido on last week talking about his book Conjuring Hitler, where he lays out a case that Hitler was a product of the Anglo-American Empire intelligence operation combined with Wall Street and the City of London to install a radical reactionary like Hitler in order to drive a wedge between Germany and USSR, or more generally between Europe and Asia, for their own strategic purposes of dividing and conquering that continent and in furtherance of their objectives of dominating the world. So, Guido, I thought we could fill in any blanks that you think we didn't get to last week, important issues that...
I just want to specify, it's not that I believe that he was, I mean, your summary is fine, but it's not that he was a product of, I mean, they didn't create him, but... The phenomenon of Nazism and the Hitlerism itself is something that it's hard to say how it came about. What is certain is that the victors of Versailles were expecting a reactionary movement they could use. That's a fact. That's as I mentioned, that famous writing by Thorsten Veblen last week, people seen this coming for sure. That it would come under that form, that I have absolutely no way of proving and knowing how. I don't think it was predicted by the intelligence or the political powers, but certainly creating conditions where a military regime might rise again to use again Russia, not to antagonize Russia per se, but to involve Germany in a new war in which the country would be destroyed once and for all. There's no doubt about that. There's evidence for that.
Right. Okay. I didn't mean to imply that they were pulling his strings like a puppet, but certainly he was a consequence of their strategy. So, is there any indication, by the way, of any concern or misgivings that they might have had about Hitler once he did take power and started murdering people en masse?
Misgivings at what point? During the war or soon after power?
For instance, the Holocaust.
Misgivings about what?
Well, I understand that some of these prison camps were not bombed by the Allies. Of course, there would have been so-called collateral damage at that point.
Yeah, about the role of the Allies vis-à-vis the camps, there's a huge literature about how they knew everything and then didn't act. I don't know if that's the case. I have not looked into that very much. So it might be the case. I mean, certainly there's already a case in what was that, 1938, when they were just thinking of plans of evacuating Jews, and there was one famous case where it was called the Ship of Fools. And it was this boat full of expatriates, Jews that had been expelled and that demanded shelter in the U.S. and that they were refused entry in the country. And so there were instances where, nowadays, of course, there's all this tremendous emphasis on the Holocaust of the Jews, but at the time, it didn't seem that much of a priority in the agenda of the Western powers in dealing with Hitler. And of course, there's one of the biggest question marks in the history of World War II. It's the fact that the Western Front was pretty much silent for the length of 3 years, and one wonders why they just gave the Germans 3 years to move east and do what they did without intervening. Not until the Great Armada was brought across the Atlantic, and that the Germans were closed in on two fronts again. But for roughly 3 years they weren't, and the big question is how come? And the answers of current historiography is that they weren't ready, or it was unrealistic that all this massive American army could be moved so fast when Stalin was asking already for help, but it's not true. And they could have moved. And the chief of general staff of the U.S. Army repeatedly asked to intervene and was stopped repeatedly by Churchill, saying that the conditions were not yet right. And during that time, Germans penetrated further east, eventually to suffer a number of discomfitures, but the carnage began for sure. That time. So that's one of the big questions, one of the several.
There was some ideological affinity between, for instance, the Bush family and specific fascistic tendencies in Germany, prior to and during World War II. I know that Guardian article that you referenced last week. How Hitler's grandfather helped Hitler's rise. How Bush's grandfather helped Hitler's rise to power. Actually, the Bush family was sued by survivors of Auschwitz, who mm-hmm. claimed that they had benefited financially from slave labor at Auschwitz. And we also know that Prescott Bush was involved in an attempted military overthrow of the U.S. government in an attempt to institute a fascistic regime here, and you know, he walked away with total impunity. And you know, it's just like the Bush family has a coat of Teflon. They can commit treason repeatedly, and of course George W., the grandson, has repeatedly committed treason against this country in his violation of the U.S. Constitution, and leading us into wars under false pretenses. So it seems as though we have an aristocrat class in this country, which is above the law, and has demonstrated no affinity whatsoever for the well-being of the citizens of this country or its laws. So I think it's time for people to start using the word treason and traitor more freely here. This is not, you know, maybe nationalism has gotten a bad name. You know, at its best, nationalism is nothing more than an expression of community and mutual support among a large group of people. And, you know, maybe it's time for American citizens to take pride again in their roots and, you know.
I agree. About the plot, I guess you mentioned the plot against, it was a plot against FDR, right?
Yes, uh-huh.
Yeah, and as for, yes, and I mentioned that thing last week, treason. As I said, I don't think there were fascistic affinity whatsoever. I don't think that the people at the Bank of England that helped the Nazis with financial means and so on, or the Bushes, had any kind of attraction for the Nazis in any way. I think these were just Machiavellian policies. You know, you have an enemy, you have an objective, and you do whatever's needed. So, which in this case implies that first you have to help or inflate this enemy in order to have then an opportunity to smash him once and for all, which was what was eventually needed. As far as treason and all these things go, I agree. It's, but we've seen after 9/11, and especially the run up to the second Gulf War, how difficult it has been to wrest any kind of power away from this aristocracy, as you say, which is indeed the case. I mean, as they say all the time, the U.S. Senate is a house of millionaires and have absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with the reality of the American Commonwealth, so to speak. And but you know, we all have tried in a variety of ways of doing what some call loyal opposition, of reclaiming some things, and they have constructed things in such a way that it's been virtually impossible, because they have portrayed and they have staged all these new wars. They are most of them phony wars. I mean, those of the Gulf War are entirely staged wars. They're not real. The first one wasn't real, the second one either. And they now stage things, as I was saying last time, in such a way that they're always perceived, the country's perceived as being aggressed from without. And now they have enemies of choice who seem out of, generally come out of Walt Disney movies. I'm thinking of the Bin Laden template and the evil caliph of Aladdin, things like that. And we're past that era in the 60s where the enemy was some dashing communist like Che Guevara or people like that that held a certain kind of charisma. These days, the enemies that we have today are totally unpalatable. And if you couple that with the perception of being aggressed from without, you just generate a climate of fear and of credulousness and of confusion, such that those who really want to do something are finding it extremely difficult. And in fact, those who have tried are immediately tagged as un-American, unpatriotic, and this and that and the other, conspiracy, mad people, and it's become, I know, I remember, it was impossible to do anything. There were a few marches against the war, and what was that, March of 03, but it died down, it died out very, very fast. And the sentiment of patriotism, of being one with the country, was not just peculiarity of the right, but it extended to the left as well, and I think that was part of the problem. In the end, there was this closing of ranks. What was left was nothing, and two people trying to do something were pushed to the fringes and easily accused of being far right conspiracy nuts.
Well, this is crazy, as if the right has a monopoly on common sense. You know, you look at 9/11 and you have to ask, you know, why did the FBI confiscate the videotapes showing the object that ran into the Pentagon? Why do we still not know who took out the put options?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. But you remember when 9/11 happened, I mean, Laura Bush went on, and there was the article, and she went public saying that we're also fighting in Afghanistan to liberate the women. Of course it was. It was outrageous.
That's a joke.
It was interesting to see that the outrage was not as strong as I expected it would be. They used a lot of this diversity jargon, that we're going there for democracy, for difference. And I must say that it has worked. They have stolen a lot of the slogans of the left very successfully.
Yes.
And you're seeing the incapacitation of the left. I mean, a lot of people want to do something, but they weren't able to do that much.
It's amazing. It's like they have put Prozac in the water or something. The left is completely incapacitated.
It's very disappointing.
I mean,
they have been very afraid. I mean, if you think the last leftist we really have in the U.S. is, no matter how outrageous it might sound, it's Michael Moore, who's extremely, extremely cautious in the way in which he phrases his own.
I self-identify as a leftist. I don't know whether that's... maybe I would be kicked out of a lot of leftist groups. I don't know, but... to me, 9/11 was quite obviously a false flag operation. You don't have buildings falling at free fall speed without doing
something. Of course it was. Yeah. But you say these things, and there are such magazines, leftist magazines, who adamantly and categorically refuse to deal with this, and are getting pretty aggressive against people who doubt, in good faith. Conventional explanation. There's a great deal of fear. There's no question.
Well, I don't think that this is an occasion for fear. I think this is an occasion for outrage. This is an occasion to ask, you know, demand answers to how this could have happened, and, you know, how is it that clearly these buildings were brought down by controlled demolition, and why don't we know who did it? You know, do we really expect the government to investigate itself and find itself guilty of this kind of stuff?
Of course, the Constitution asks for due process. This thing happened in America, then there should have been a trial, should have uncovered the responsibility for these attacks. There was no such thing. All we saw was a joint press conference of Blair and Bush, and 2 weeks later the troops were landing in Afghanistan. Afghanistan, of all places, as if by dark magic. I mean... and it's interesting that there's a sale of Al Qaeda just springing up wherever the U.S. has geopolitical interest. I mean, how very convenient.
How convenient, yes. This is, you know, I have something to play that has a direct bearing on this. If you can, if you'd like to listen to it, I'd like to play it on the air. It's about 7 minutes long. Does that sound all right?
What is it, I'm sorry?
I have something I downloaded from the net about this specific issue about 9/11.
Okay,
hold on.
Those who have studied history know that nothing invigorates and empowers an authoritarian regime more than a spectacular act of violence, some sudden and senseless loss of life that allows the autocrat to stand on the smoking rubble and identify himself as the hero. It's at moments like this that the public, still in shock from the horror of the tragedy that has just unfolded before them, can be led into the most ruthless despotism. Despotism that now bears the mantle of security. Acts of terror and violence never benefit the average man or woman. They only ever benefit those in positions of power. This is why Nero fiddled while Rome burned. It gave him a chance to throw out the Christians to the lions and rebuild the capital of the Roman Empire in his own image. This is why Hearst and the warmongers of the emerging American Empire were delighted by the destruction of the USS Maine in Havana Harbor in 1898. It gave them the excuse they needed to rouse the public into supporting the Spanish-American War. This is why Israel attacked the USS Liberty in 1967 during the Six-Day War, strafing and torpedoing it relentlessly for hours in a vain attempt to send it to the bottom. The Israelis believed that the loss of the Liberty could be blamed on Egypt and draw the Americans into war. This is why there are hundreds of documented examples of government staging attacks in order to blame them on their political enemies. In every civilization, in every culture, in every historical period, authoritarians have known that spectacular acts of violence help to further consolidate their own power and control. And sadly, throughout history, there have been all too many willing to allow attacks to occur, to pretend that attacks have occurred, or even to attack their own population in order to further their political agenda. To think that such staged provocations and false flag attacks no longer occur would be as unrealistic as believing that human nature itself has changed, that powerful people no longer seek to increase their power, that influence is never used for deceit or manipulation, that lies are no longer told to satisfy greed or slake the thirst for control. It is to believe that our society is immune from those things that we have seen in every other society, in every other era. In short, it's a dangerous delusion. The people are once again learning the power of this delusion. They are learning the extent to which they have been lied to. They are once again studying their history. The Russians are learning how the FSB was caught planting bombs in Moscow in 1999 during a terror scare that swept Putin into power and stirred the public into supporting the Second Chechen War. They are learning how their autocratic ex-president came to power campaigning on the graves of those his old FSB cronies had killed. The Israelis are learning how Mossad has been caught time and again posing as the very Muslim terrorists they claim to be opposing. They are learning how Israel uses the specter of terror to further extend their blank check drawn on American funds to expand their police state at home and maintain their hardline stance, the world's sixth largest nuclear superpower supposedly threatened by the possibility that one of their neighbors may one day obtain a single nuclear weapon. The British are learning how their SAS officers were caught dressing up as Arabs in Iraq, driving around with trucks full of munitions, shooting at police to stir up ethnic tensions and ensure that permanent bases could be built in the region. They are learning how Harun Aswat, the supposed mastermind behind the 7/7 bombings, was working for British intelligence. They are learning how British military intelligence took part in IRA bombings. The Indians are learning how the Mumbai attack was helped by a U.S. agent who is cooperating with investigators so that he won't face questioning by foreign authorities. The Canadians are learning how their own provincial police dressed up as protesters in 2007 and threatened violence against other police in order to force a crackdown on peaceful protests. And the Americans. The Americans are learning that there were multiple bombs found, dismantled, and taken out of the Alfred P. Murrah building on April 19, 1995. They are learning that Timothy McVeigh had written a letter to his sister in which he claimed to be in the Special Forces for the U.S. Army. They are learning the bombing was being directed by FBI informants, just as the 1993 World Trade Center bombing was. They are learning about 9/11 and the Gulf of Tonkin and Operation Northwoods and their own Army counterinsurgency manuals that teach officers how to commit false flag attacks to blame on their enemies. In short, the people are learning the truth. And now we see the same build-up to a false flag event taking place that we saw in 1995. At that time, the U.S. had a corporate media desperate to fling mud at anyone concerned by the actions of their government, and it had a government that was desperately unpopular. Today, we see the exact same factors at play. If anything, the situation today is worse than it was in the run-up to the Oklahoma City bombing, with media consolidation meaning that groups of concerned citizens like the Oath Keepers are being attacked by the controlled minions on both the left and the right. And now it is not just the militia that is being demonized by the establishment. It is veterans and gun owners, third-party supporters and libertarians, anti-war protesters, and human rights campaigners, people who are upset with a government giving trillions to the banks that have engineered our current financial crisis. In short, everyone is now a potential terrorist, according to the governmental and media agencies that deign to limit our range of acceptable opinion and control dissent. Even the word terrorist means something more than it did back in 1995. Now, after the false flag attack of 2001 allowed the passage of the Patriot Act, after the boogeyman of Al Qaeda gave the NSA the opportunity to announce that they were collecting everyone's emails and everyone's telephone calls, after the former White House press secretary came out and admitted that the Bush administration had made up terror threats in order to scare the people into supporting the government, now we know what the real definition of terrorism is. It is governments scaring their own populations into line. But there is something else that's different now from what it was in 1995. The people are learning something else about terrorism. They are not terrorists for speaking out against their government. They are not terrorists for wanting the government to stop selling their children into servitude to pay bankers their bonuses. They are not terrorists for pointing out that the FBI and the CIA and Mossad and MI6 are behind every major international terrorist event. The people are not terrorists because they do not want to see more death. They do not want more destruction. The spilling of the blood of their fellow citizens is not in their interests. Death and destruction only ever serve the governmental and financial and industrial interests who always grow in power and wealth in the wake of every tragedy. Time and again, the people pay with their lives, and the governments and the banks and the war machine only grows and prospers. The people do not want terrorism because it does not benefit them. It only benefits the existing power structure. And this time, if there is another staged event to blame on the government's enemy of the day, the people will know who to blame. For the Corbett Report in Western Japan, I am James Corbett.
That was from Corbett Report, CORBETT report.com. I thought it was pretty penetrating insights he had there. Well phrased and everything. Patricia, are you still there? Guido, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Patricia's been having phone problems here. Okay. So, maybe we could get some into the... I was wanting to investigate some of the occult beliefs of the Nazis and maybe see if there might be parallels among the people who attend the Bohemian Grove.
I don't know about the Bohemian Grove. There are connections, and these things deal with rituals of sex magic. That's I saw the link you sent me about the reporting on these things. These stories of sex magic, from what I know, from what I read. I'm not an initiate of those kinds of things in any way. Apparently, it's been going on for a long time, and supposedly they have also happened in the circles, in esoteric circles that were close to Nazism. I've heard this story from people who have investigated these things. I don't remember seeing any kind of document in the few things that there are studying the occult roots of Nazism that mentioned. Rituals of sex magic, of which, of course, Aleister Crowley is the best known figure in the 20th century, and we have in pop iconography, I think, one of the most famous, if not the only one, as far as I know, representation of these things in that in Kubrick's last movie, Eyes Wide Shut. But again, I don't know if those things and using sex as a ritual. Of channeling power and then using it for purposes of world control was used by the Nazis. Maybe, I don't know. What is known of the Nazis is that for sure they were part. Their elite was part, as I said last week, of a group of initiates who had some of whom were versed in magic. That is also seems to be ascertained, and who held a very peculiar beliefs. About creation and what the races were doing in this world, and conceived, as far as I can tell, the world as a battle of spirit guides. Spirit guides being what we would call, in positivist parlance, cultures. But for them, it was more super sensible entities which were represented collectively by peoples. And vying for control of this world, and not so much for this world. The Nazis had this very strange vision that theirs was a race of light, a race of God-men, hailing from another dimension. And this is typical of this Gnostic imagery that fell and find itself encrusted like diamonds into this world, and that there were forces that were bacteriological forces, and this is the language they used in describing the Jews, bacteriological presence that was necessary to their progression as a race in the cosmic evolution for a while, antagonistic and noxious to them, but necessary for this travail and this ordeal they had to go through, and out of which they of which they had to distance themselves and purify and purge themselves of this mixture of undivine, of non-divine substance, and reach a salvific realm somewhere else. I mean, this is part of the particular beliefs of Gnosis, of being of the race of gods, falling into a foreign earth and then seeking purification away from it. And that you find, and Jews are portrayed as the antimatter, so to speak, which holds them down for a while before they will be free to ascend and leave a world that is not the one they were made for. So there's all this eschatological promise and things of that sort, which live through the myths of German sagas and the music of Wagner, and which formed a self-contained whole in which the Nazis and Hitler view themselves. And a lot of these, you know, this symbology is common to a lot of groups, not all of them Nazis. You know, initiates share many aspects of this common doctrine, but they of course have different uses for it, as far as I understand.
It sounds like,
in a nutshell, this would be from what I get.
It sounds like, from,
yes.
I was just going to say this sounds like it would feed right into eugenics. The idea that
eugenics has this fixation of the sterilization of the unfit, of purification of the bloodline. One wonders why they were so insistent on purifying the bloodline. According to esoteric writings, the purity of blood afforded ancestral memory. But this was a long time ago, and supposedly and allegedly, and actually factually, we, according to spiritualists, we have lost this capacity of seeing through the eyes of our ancestors. So I don't exactly understand what they were hoping to achieve by recreating pure lines of blood. But yeah, eugenics was certainly an experiment whose deeper esoteric roots were common to this, although the society, eugenic societies were presented as very clinical and rational endeavors. But this substratum of belief, which is very not the Christian one, it's something different. To me, it's there. There's no doubt about it.
I need to do a station break and play a short blurb here, and we'll be right back.
This program brought to you by listener support and a donation from Smoke and Chicks Barbecue. Smoke and Chicks Barbecue serves up a fresh and flavorful selection of meats, sides, desserts, and specialty items. They can cater your tailgate or holiday party, or you can visit them at their restaurant at 4603 John Gary Drive in Columbia. More information available at smokeandchicksbbq.com or at 256-6450. Smoke and Chicks Barbecue, mouth-watering, finger-licking barbecue.
So yeah, I think it's, there are strange parallels to me between elite American culture, eugenics. I believe Hitler was inspired to some degree by the American eugenics and British eugenics movements. I know he was construction of these death camps in Germany, the mass execution camps. This was pioneered by German psychiatry. The notion that you could have an industrial scale mass murder facility, and with a convenient method of disposal of the bodies. This was pioneered by German psychiatry, which was closely allied in its ideological underpinnings with Western, American and British psychiatry.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some disturbing parallels here, and certainly the fact that...
Well, yes, the eugenic societies in America and Britain, and I think also in Scandinavian, were active in the... I'm pretty sure 20s and 30s, extremely active. how this reverberated on the Nazis themselves, who came first and who influenced whom. I don't know. I don't know if they gave Hitler, if they gave the SS and Nazis the idea. I wouldn't be able to say, although I don't know. But certainly they share some.
It is disturbing, though. It's disturbing that the Bush family basically profited from the Nazis. You know, they were able to keep $1.5 million. That's of what the U.S. government knew that they had gained from their dealings with Fritz Thyssen during World War II. And not only did they profit from the Nazis, they actually, you know, Prescott Bush went on to become a senator, and of course his son and grandson became presidents. So I think.
But in strategic and purely strategic and cynical terms, I mean, if all that eventually led to the destruction of Germany, which was the number one objective, I mean, you could say that these people have done their job, right? If that's what the name of the game is. Of course, from our viewpoint, this is not, you know, we're pacifists, but for us, this doesn't make any sense. But for those who reason in terms of power, yes, this is what needs to be done to achieve the objective, so be it.
Right.
They should go scot-free. They have done their imperial work.
So this is not just history we're talking about. The fact that these people did this with total impunity and went on to take public office, high public office, implies, I think, that there's a good case to be made that the interests, the institutions and families which were involved in this catastrophe are still in power today.
Absolutely. This is why it's virtually impossible to discuss these things in an urbane fashion and anywhere. In academia, it's impossible. But that's why. I mean, it's too close.
Yeah.
And then, of course, one may censure the Prescott Bush and the Bush family and so on, but what about Truman? He dropped a couple of bombs on defenseless populations when the war was already won.
Yeah.
It would be unnecessary. No matter what they do, there's no need of doing that.
Yes, this didn't start with
World War. How do you judge that?
Right, but the fact is, this goes back, this goes way back before World War II. It goes back into the.
I know, you're right, but this is a whole endeavor. This is an imperial endeavor,
yes,
which has been systematically conducted on several fronts with a determination, a lucidity, and cynicism beyond anything. You know, a great. It has been done. There is a reason. I mean, there's a rationale for these things, and they come at the price of the Holocaust. These hecatombs, these just mass slaughters. This is what I was made of.
But I would argue that they're in no sense serving even the national interest. Even if you know, from the most cynical viewpoint of.
Absolutely not. I agree with you. They don't. They serve an idea of empire, which transcends the notion of nation, which uses nations. The nations are finished anyway.
Yeah,
there are very few
it
exceptions.
Seems that way. Yeah.
We are in an era that nationhood is finished. We are something beyond that.
Well, we're under occupation. We're under occupation by transnational finance, I think.
To a degree, sure. Yeah, finance, transnational finance and corporations are part of this. Of this design, sure, but it's, as I said last time, they are subordinated to political strategic decisions which are conducted in Washington and London mostly. I mean,
right.
So those who rule, those who dictate the pace, today are there, not anywhere else. And the economic arm of these things are, yes, banks and corporations, and they are instrumental into sustaining this particular system of domination.
It seems as though all any criminal needs to do is wrap themselves in the flag, and if they have enough money, they can get away with anything. I mean,
these days it pays to do that. I mean, these days you protest against war, you're the macho, not the one who's wrapping the flag.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot more guts to do the other thing.
And in the background, there's this huge herd of sheep that are waiting for somebody to tell them what to do. And hoping that by keeping their heads down, they'll be safe. You know,
who's in the background?
The sheep, the mass population that isn't paying attention to the news.
Yeah, well, this is what I meant by fear, and you disagreed. By fear, I mean just people are afraid of, you know, of their safety, of their jobs. They feel blackmailable. They insecurity. I mean, this is a huge, and you know, we're all vulnerable to that viewpoint, and this makes us very cautious.
But you know,
manifesting dissent. It's a very basic thing, just like protesting against and demanding peace, demanding an end to military expansion. Basic things, very hard. And which also brings you to question things. And as I said, it's not long before people start telling you that something dangerous or something disturbing, territorially inclined. Worse, that's racist and fascist. And God knows what else. They all have these tags ready for you.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So, Patricia, did you manage to get back on? Okay, I guess not. I just want to stress to the listener that it's okay to use the word treason and traitor. I think that's exactly who we're dealing with. You know, this is, 600 and something days since Obama took office, and we still have seen no prosecutions of the Bush administration for the war crimes and the crimes against humanity and the crimes against the Constitution that these people conducted.
I never thought for a moment this would happen. I mean, the state of the generation from that viewpoint is so far advanced. What they have achieved under those 8 years of, you know, conservative rule is extraordinary.
Well, even liberal.
Obama is upholding the same rhetoric. I mean, he took power, and then a few weeks later, attacks were carried against Afghanistan to kill hundreds of women and children, if I remember correctly. And they sent Marines with money to the damages to these families, and nobody said anything about this. And a few months later, they gave Obama the Nobel Prize for Peace. And at this point, I mean, it's
ludicrous.
It's really hard to say anything. You're in a state of complete powerlessness. And
well, I don't think.
I mean, nothing's really changed.
I don't think
the line is the same.
I don't think we are powerless. I don't think this is a time for fear. This is a time for outrage. This is a time to demand action, you know, of each other, if not the government. It really is.
I agree, but where is it? I would like to see you.
Well, the first thing we need to do is get the left off its butt and get them to recognize what is so obvious to people who have their eyes open, that these people, just because they wrap themselves in the flag doesn't mean they're not traitors. Doesn't mean they're not massive.
I know. Well, I can tell you that when my book came out, I had a colleague, you know, an academic, who wrote a very fine review of it and tried to post it in all the major leftist websites in the United States, and was turned down. Nobody wants to hear any of this. So not academic.
That's amazing. You've heard of Project Censored?
No.
Project Censored is a media. They expose censored stories, stories that they deem to be important, that are not being covered by the American media, they have gotten, you know, over the years, extensive coverage on the usual leftist websites and news outlets like Democracy Now. But ever since they started talking about 9/11. Being something other than what it was claimed, they've been totally marginalized, and you know, Project Censored is being censored.
They start to shut down websites.
Well, the websites that used to carry their stories, Project Censored's stories, are no longer carrying them. And Democracy Now, I don't think, has covered them at all ever since they started talking about 9/11. So there's really a totalitarian mentality on the left, which is at least as you know, uniform and coercive as anything you'll see on the right.
I know. Well, I mean, they did a fabulous job. I mean, right now, what we call the discursive playing, propaganda, whatever you want to call it, or the language of activism, and U.S. is being polarized. I mean, on the one hand, you have the neoconservative hawks, and you know what they say and what they do. And on the other hand, you have the left, which has entrenched itself into this language of diversity. And all they do is talk about how different we are. And everything is just broken down along these lines of demarcation, be they of race, of sex, of whatever other thing. And so when the time comes to close ranks, we can't do it because we've been divided by a generation of talk about how different we are, about how differently we feel, and all these things which are completely in opposition to what the peace movement was in the 60s. And we are exactly the same thing, and we should close ranks because we're the same and we want the same thing. Then we want a basic peaceful life.
I think there's a great deal of common ground between left and right. I don't think it's in very many people's interest for this country to be taken over in a slow-motion coup, to be impoverished and looted and sold to the highest bidder around the world. You know, this is something that the left and right should be able to agree on. And if they can't, then we need new leadership on both sides.
And what I'm saying is that what we call left and the right are pretty much now in the same category, and as far as wanting to do something and change and protesting against war, it's been virtually impossible. It's been very difficult.
At least
it's been my experience up until 2008. That's when I was in the States, and then I left.
There seems to be, though, a bipartisan consensus among both Democrats and Republicans that we need to export U.S. jobs to China, and this myth of free trade.
Of course.
Now, this is outright treason, of course. This is destroying this country, and it seems to be an
sure.
agenda.
But,
which,
you know, the United States has stopped manufacturing things in the mid-60s already. This has been a long process. They don't manufacture it. It used to be. American manufacturing system used to be one of the gems of the American economy, but it's gone. The mentality now is different. Everything is, as they say, outsourced. But they keep managerial control of it. But it's very much a system. It's an imperial system.
But they've undermined confidence in the dollar to a great degree. And China and Russia are now starting to deal bilaterally in their own currencies.
I know they say that. I still don't see the weakness of the dollar. To be honest with you, I think the dollar is still there.
Okay.
Yes, it might have been in a position of weakness throughout the boom, the housing boom, and now of course it's suffering because of the collapse, the meltdown, and this difficult times because of the undigested part, the undigested cycle of the foreclosures. But there's this trend in some European circles to say that American power is at a low point at this time. It's on the defensive, definitely. It's not a moment of boisterous posing, but it will come back. They're still very strong, very strong.
You think it will come back?
It'll come back in a bad way. They will reinflate another bubble, I think. This is how they operate. The inflating of the bubbles is key for attracting capital, world capital, world saving onto the American market. And all that money is used eventually to finance the budgets of the state, part of it which is going to military expenditure and all sorts of operations abroad. I mean, this has been one of their standard operational techniques of the American system. And this is the third bubble we've had so far, and fuel bubbles they call them. That's exactly what it is, and they're just waiting now to shed some weight before starting again. Who knows when that will happen, how it will happen, and if it will happen, but I think most likely it will. I don't know if they will be able to do this for how many other times, but this is certainly how the system is built, and that's what it's waiting for. Another bubble. It is.
Well, in some ways I hope they can maintain the illusion for a little while longer, but the longer this goes on, the worse it's going to be in this country. The austerity measures that are going into effect in Europe are a prelude to what's going to happen. It's probably going to be the worst of all in the United States.
The next one, so they say. I don't know. I've not looked into it yet. Studying right now a little bit the conditions of this crisis, I want to understand. I was convinced the stagnation would have been so long, so I didn't predict things well. But I don't know. This is I'm thinking in the same terms as you are. So what do we need to do in order to bring peace and make things stable and not as crazy as they are now? It looks daunting. I believe in communal thing. I believe in movement from the grassroots. I believe in regional currencies, introducing regional currencies that in certain cases make up for the money that is not issued by the banks. Where people should, you know, communities should get together, organize networks, and issue the currencies to sustain themselves as parallel or complementary currency. That would be one aspect, and empower the people where they are at the bases and in their homes and in the regions and so on and so forth, and trying to get a little bit of democracy back and expressing what we want, which is, you know, simpler lives and none of this war business and so on. It's tough, but it has to start from the base and from communal activism. And there's a lot of that. There used to be a lot of that. It still is in the U.S. And hopefully it will get organized. I mean, this is where I would look. This is where I would look for an answer, for a solution.
A lot of people are talking about the monetary system these days. Monetary.org has a proposed bill called the American Monetary Act, which everyone needs to check out. It sounds like just what we need. Basically, the national debt is a voluntary legislative creation of the United States government. It doesn't have to exist. They could write it off the books tomorrow, and they could do it in a way which would not disrupt the markets.
Yeah, that's interesting. That would be good. I don't know. I mean, it's going to be not exactly easy, but yeah, I'd love to read the proposal. I'll see what it means.
Yeah. Dennis Kucinich is behind it. I mean, he supports it.
I'm sorry?
Dennis Kucinich, he's a well-respected...
Oh, okay, of course. Yes. I know that movement, yes. The Monetary Institute, of course, I know them very well. They want to nationalize the Federal Reserve.
Among other things, yes.
It's a bold project. I spoke to them. I think it'd be sure pursue that, but in the meantime, have the people organize themselves and start to issue currencies on a regional basis.
Right.
It's simpler than trying to take over the fortress. A lot simpler. It's still very hard, but simpler than the other one.
What do you think about time limited currency that expires after a given period?
Yeah, I did a lot of work on that.
Is that right?
One of those who have written on these things, I think it's revolutionary. I think it's exactly what it is. Money that dies, which is what it should be doing. If money is a reflection of goods, if the goods themselves have life cycles, how come money never has a life cycle? And the money that we deal with, money that is imperishable, in fact,
I believe
they should die. They should have an expiration date. And this is how some pilot experiments have been conducted in Germany and other places.
The Isle of...
Very limited. But on the right track.
The Isle of...
It should be.
The Isle of Guernsey, I believe, did this about a century
Who?
Ago. Guernsey?
Yes, the Isle of Guernsey. But there are many others.
Yeah.
There are several other communes in Switzerland and Germany. And, of course, there's a whole history of that. There are articles on my website where I've written at length about the literature on these things and what they do and why there's hope that we could use these things and how completely wholesome they are, in my view.
Yeah, I mean...
They are very much linked to regional, communal basis.
It doesn't take much reflection to understand that if you have roads to be built and bridges and hospitals and doctors to be trained and all these things that need to be done, and you have all these unemployed people... And somehow the unemployed people can't be matched up with the jobs that need to be done simply because there's not enough dollars in circulation.
I know. There's not dollars because they don't invest. Right now the banks are full of money.
Yeah.
But they don't invest because the rate of profitability that they see from this current state is not enticing. So they just communities rot until the times are right, and then a new boom happens.
Exactly,
happy, and goes on in cycles of 5 to 6 years, and then
the Great Depression
from euphoria.
The Great Depression was a great example of this. It seems to be part of their business model. These elite.
It's mostly an effect of the monetary system. Mm-hmm. Monetary system as such, it's a system of issuing money at a price. And if the which is the interest, and if the rate of profitability that may be exacted from this issuance, from this loan that this industry, the banking industry, gives you, if the rate of profitability that they foresee, that is expected from the economy and all, what the money they can get away from you, it doesn't cover what they're charging you, they're not going to lend it to you. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
Rule of business. If you cover overhead, you proceed. And if you don't, you go on a few months and then you shut down. And right now, we're in shutdown time.
Right. But
and this is why. Generally, as it happened, in case of emergency, some communities decide to say, well, confound this, I am going to print my own money in a communal mint. And the banks may do what they want, but we will have these coupons, which represent labor, and time, in certain cases, there's a time-dated coupons, and which to reemploy people. This works fast, of course, in communities that are self-contained and depend on one single industry, as it has happened in the 1930s. But these things have happened. I mean, this is money issued by communal mint in duplication of the other circuits, traditional banking circuits, which were not forthcoming in lending any money in times of crisis. So, money is just a symbol to make things circulate, so why can't we just issue it?
Exactly. That's what Lincoln did in the Civil War. We had greenbacks in circulation in this country.
Yeah, he needed money to fight that war, I know.
That's
but
right.
Hopefully, if we'll do this one day, it will not be for any war.
That's right. Well, I mean, so many of these wars have been driven by the banking interests, you know, behind the scenes. It seems as though.
Yeah.
So it's getting close to the end of the hour. Would you like to plug your website? You have a website online?
Yeah, no, sure. My website is www.widoprepara.com. That's just my name. And there's a bunch of things there. There's the books that I published and articles. And so one may download what one wants from it.
Could you spell that website? Spell out the name.
Sure. www.guidoprepara.com.
All right. Good. So, is there anything, any closing things you want to say? Help us make sense of this chaos that seems to be enveloping the world.
No, I just thank you a lot for having me with you in these two sessions, and just keep me posted, and hopefully, you know, I wish you and all your colleagues the best in bringing back some wholesome pacifist movement in your lands, and hopefully just fight a good fight, although it's not a fight, it's a movement for seeing things improve.
It's just an expansion, of awareness. It's an expansion of awareness. It's not really a fight. It's just understanding. It's spreading of understanding.
Yeah. And hopefully, yes. And hopefully, more people will join without being afraid that what is being proposed here is just not anything insane, but just a desire of denouncing injustice where we see it.
And the empire is based on lies, and lies are very fragile things.
Well, so, the game of power is based on lies, and unfortunately it is. And they're very proud, some of them, politicians, of how capable they are in doing all that. Sometimes they say for the best.
Right.
I don't know.
Okay,
maybe I'm just naive. I don't know.
Well, me too. I guess I'd have to be that way then also. I need to sign off, so I appreciate your coming on. And I encourage the listeners to go out and check out your website, and hope for the best. Thank you very much. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The monster's gone, he's on.